It's a great pleasure to welcome you to another episode of Across the Pond, where we discuss the big stories and top investment ideas from the Eurozone and Switzerland. Donald Trump started making his stamp on global politics even before his return to the White House, by paving the way for a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. With that under his belt, the returning president looks likely to be turning his attention to the war between Russia and Ukraine, a conflict he said he could end in 24 hours. That could provide a much-needed boost to Europe. The region suffered more than the US from a hit to confidence and from higher energy prices after the war started back in February 2022. I'm Christopher Swan.
And I'm Belinda Peters. In this episode, we'll be asking what kind of settlement is possible. Are we going back to the golden days of cheap energy for Europe with an end to sanctions on Russia, or is a mere ceasefire likely? Finally, and most crucially, which parts of the European equity market stand to gain most from peace, and where should investors consider putting their funds? Stay tuned for the answers.
This week, we're joined by Temis Temistoklis, head of the Chief Investment Office for EMEA. Thanks for taking the time, Temis.
Great to be here, Chris.
Yeah, so first, maybe let's start with something really basic, which is how the Russia-Ukraine war affected Europe. I think it's fair to say that the impact was considerably worse for the Eurozone than it was for the US. Why was that?
Yeah, it's not a surprise at all. The US is self-sufficient in gas. If anything, they export gas. Gas prices following the war were reasonably stable in the US. If you compare that to Europe, about 80% of European gas was pipeline gas, out of which more than 40% came from Russia. And that pipeline gas was at a big discount to prevailing LNG prices. And following the war, obviously with a big interruption of gas flow into Europe, Europe needed to find gas from the international markets. Gas prices in Europe went up by more than 10 times. So big spike in prices, which affected manufacturing, but also the consumer, because the consumer used gas for heating and cooking and that sort of thing. So it was a big shock to manufacturing because they faced much higher costs, but also the consumer because suddenly the cost of living went up substantially. And that led to lower consumption, lower manufacturing production. And of course, with the war being so in such a close proximity to Europe, there was also a hit to sentiment. So if you combine all of that, obviously the shock to Europe was a lot more material relative to what happened in the US, which there was no material change in energy prices.
Mm-hmm. And Temis, as Chris mentioned earlier, Trump claimed he could resolve the war in Ukraine within 24 hours of taking office, which has not happened yet. And more recently, he has threatened to impose more tariffs and stricter sanctions on Russia if President Putin refuses to negotiate a peace deal. So what can we then expect from Trump's approach now that he's back in office?
Yeah, thanks, Belinda. I would actually split the potential outcomes into three groups. The one is putting Ukraine agreed to enter negotiations. That's one. Number two is to agree to a ceasefire. And number three, potentially have a lasting agreement. And all three have very different probabilities. But the Mr. Trump, the first sort of challenge he has is to convince Putin to come to the negotiating table to start with, agree to a ceasefire, second, maybe have a lasting agreement. And that most probably is the challenge. From the Ukrainian side, I think the Ukrainian government is more than willing to enter negotiations, maybe agree to a ceasefire, but obviously a lasting agreement requires a lot more work, and I think it's also much lower probability. What can Mr. Trump do to convince the different parties to come to the negotiating table? With Ukraine, obviously, has a lot of leverage because the U.S. provides financial assistance, they provide military assistance. So any threat to disrupt that would very quickly bring the Ukrainian side to the negotiating table. The more difficult challenge is how do you convince Putin to come to the negotiating table at a time when he's basically winning ground on the war against Ukraine. And there, I suppose, we've already seen some signs from Mr. Trump threatening sanctions. My guess is going to be a combination of stick and carrot. More sanctions, maybe threatened that would supply Ukraine with more weapons, longer range weapons, with no restrictions what they can hit with those weapons. At the same time, when maybe he can offer some carrots, potentially alleviating some of the pressure, some of the sanctions, some other levers he can pull to try and bring them to negotiating table. So those are some of the things he can do to get them to the negotiating table. Again, for putting entering negotiations, the threshold is maybe a bit lower because he can enter the negotiations with very high demands. And then if those go nowhere, he can say, well, I tried. The other side wasn't prepared to compromise. Not my fault. It's a more difficult to bring them to agree to a ceasefire when, as I said, on the ground, they seem to be winning. And there, I think, more leverage will be needed. Lasting agreement, I think, is a lot more difficult because from the Ukrainian side, for the government to agree to a lasting solution, they would maybe be prepared to agree to forgo some of their ground, but they would definitely need some concrete security guarantees, which is basically what the government of Ukraine already mentioned. And the only way, in my mind, that you can have solid guarantees if Ukraine join NATO, which I think is a no-go for Putin. So finding some solution there, I think, has lower probabilities.
I mean, if we turn the focus sort of back to Europe and what this all means for Europe, and maybe we can just start with the outcome that you mentioned being the most likely, which was the ceasefire with sort of a rebuilding effort starting in Ukraine, repairing some of that war damage. What would you see as the most likely economic implications for Europe there?
Starting with, I think, if you do believe that there's still a hit on sentiment, maybe we see some improvement in consumer sentiment, which might come quickly. Obviously, if that ceasefire comes with some sort of reversal of sanctions, anything to do with energy sanctions, we might, on the margin, see incrementally a little bit more flow of gas into Europe. For example, Ukraine did not renegotiate the contract with Russia to supply Europe with gas through Ukraine. Could that be reversed? Could we see a little bit more gas? Possible, which could bring gas prices down a little bit. Is there a risk premium to gas prices in Europe? I'm not sure how much, but maybe again on the margin, maybe a little bit. So that could alleviate the pressure on energy prices for manufacturing, for the consumer. But also what you mentioned earlier on. So if we have a ceasefire, especially if there's a sense of it's a lasting ceasefire, then the focus would go back to reconstruction of Ukraine. And there again, Europe will be well positioned to get some of those contracts. How this is financed would have a big role to play how much business European companies will have. I mean, there's some talk of maybe reconstruction of Ukraine, possibly using frozen Russian assets. I just find it difficult to believe that Putin would agree to a ceasefire and maybe negotiate a lasting agreement when the West sort of raids those frozen assets. So I think maybe a bit less likely. If the reconstruction is financed by Europe, then I think Europe will have a big say in how the contracts are awarded. Also, we have to remember that Europe is providing substantial assistance to Ukraine, financial assistance, military assistance, something like in the order of $145 billion that Europe is already spent on helping Ukraine. If some of that assistance is redirected into infrastructure projects in Europe, or even if it's redirected to beef up the defense industry in Europe, this is still going to be benefiting the European economy. So again, there's another angle there that could be helping Europe.
Mm-hmm. And then hypothetically, in case of an ideal scenario, let's assume we get a permanent deal and an end to sanctions with natural gas starting to flow again. My first question, why do we think that is unlikely? And second, if this does occur, What could this mean, and which sectors stand to gain the most?
Yeah, again, high lower probability, but high impact potentially. The reason I'm skeptical that we're going to have a full reversal of what happened to pre the war and the gas supplies fully reestablished is that, I mean, then Europe would be seen again as being dependent on Russia for a big strategic commodity, which is gas. And in the future, for the European leader, from the Europeans' point, leaders' point of view, they will always be worried that Putin basically uses that for political reasons again. And you can imagine the population turning back to the leaders and say, just remind me again why we got ourselves into this situation, given what happened with the war in Ukraine. So I think the politicians in Europe will be very, very reluctant to get hooked into Russian gas fully. Now, on the margin, as I said, I could potentially see some more gas flowing into Europe, but again, not fully going back to what we had before. But let's for a minute assume that were to be the case, that sanctions disappear, Russian gas flows back into Europe, then the obvious beneficiaries would be the consumer, because they will have more savings and more spending power, manufacturing, energy-intensive industries like the chemical industry, for example. Then you've got to have consumer-related sectors that would be benefiting, domestic, durable consumer stocks would stand to benefit. Small caps is another area. By the way, small caps likely to benefit even in the case of just ceasefire without a full agreement, because this is a section of the European equities market that is underperformed the large caps significantly, especially over the last 3 years. And valuations, they're trading at a big discount to large caps. And those are manufacturing companies, companies that are involved also to some degree in construction. So if you have reconstruction, that's an area that will benefit. If we have a full agreement, that again is an area that's likely to benefit.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've touched on the answer to this somewhat, but basically, I mean, sort of focusing back again on the base case, you mentioned small caps, but I mean, perhaps you can draw that out a little more. But which sort of broad areas do you think would benefit most in the event of that base case outcome?
We're talking about equities.
Yes.
Yeah. Again, this is I do think that materials most probably the area that is going to be benefiting the most. If we look at Germany, which is the biggest economy in Europe and in some degrees the one that suffered the most as a result of the sharp increase in gas prices, we've seen manufacturing in energy-intensive industries declining by 22%. It's a big number. 22% decline in production. So some of that production is moved outside Germany. But also what I find, by the way, interesting is that value added in manufacturing hasn't really suffered as much as volume production. So what the industry to some degree has adjusted to the higher prices, they moved up the value chain. And as a result, in terms of value, they produce nearly the same as pre the war, but with much lower volume. But if these industries felt confident that these energy prices were lower for longer, then obviously they would be benefiting the most. And the consumer-related stocks likely to benefit.
And what about reconstruction in Ukraine? I think you mentioned that the EU and other member nations had contributed around $145 billion in aid to Ukraine. What could this mean if this assistance would be redirected to reconstruction, and how likely is this to happen?
I mean, if the war ends, Ukraine will need a major rebuild. So that is clearly required. The question is the financing of it. And as I said earlier on, depends where the financing will come. I think you have sort of different redistribution of that reconstruction contracts. But Europe will benefit anyway, whichever way, whether it's where to be frozen assets or Europe financing that reconstruction, or I don't know if the US would be prepared to spend any money on that. But that requirement would be there, even if it's last a number of years, that has to happen. And Europe will stand to benefit from that. And again, you need to think of companies in areas like materials, like construction companies, these type of companies, engineering companies will be also get involved, assume, in that reconstruction. So there will be material need. The numbers that have been mentioned in the press is something like $600 billion required to rebuild Ukraine. And that was, I don't know, that estimate was most probably 8 months ago. And obviously since then, there's more damage. So that number might be quite a bit higher. We have to be careful with that number because also includes the parts that most damage that are under Russian control. And obviously there, Russia is going to be driving the reconstruction rather than the West. But still, we're talking about big money, big numbers.
Great. And I guess, obviously, the main topic of this podcast has been the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. But obviously, it's not the only and or even the most important driver of European markets. What else do we see shaping markets this year, notably since we're trying to be a positive here, sort of things that could improve the European outlook, given, as I think you've mentioned, that Europe has been a somewhat unloved region by investors recently?
That's correct. But also there's another important element there, Chris. When we talk about Europe and especially Germany, a lot of investors think that the problems that Germany is facing is entirely having to do with manufacturing and gas prices. But also we have to remember that manufacturing in Europe and outside Europe, if you look at the US, if you look at China, it's been effectively in recession for a while now. And with Europe being quite heavy with manufacturing, especially Germany, more than 20% of the economy is manufacturing, then if manufacturing is recession, then clearly that is a cyclical element as well as a structural element. So if we're looking at things that can get better, demand for goods, manufacturing recovering, that should be beneficial for Germany and the rest of Europe. We haven't seen any signs yet. Some leading indicators seem to be saying that things might be getting a little bit better, but signs, concrete signs of a global recovery in manufacturing would be beneficial for Europe. Other elements that could be, again, beneficial and that could happen anytime in the future is the consumer. The consumer over the last couple of years in Europe, if you look at more recently, over the last, I don't know, few months, we've seen inflation coming down and wages increasing well above inflation. So these consumers have been getting real wage increases. They've been saving most of that. They haven't been spending. And if they, for some reason, feel more confident about the outlook, whatever that triggers it, that could result in better consumer demand. So again, it's another element that has been missing. If we look at services in Europe, they've been doing a little bit better. But if you look at Germany, for example, services have been still very depressed. So there's another element that can be positive. The third one is we have German elections coming up in February. I think I would say the consensus is that a new government would definitely focus more on the economy, more likely to increase spending, more likely to look at taxation, potentially bringing corporate taxes down. Corporate taxes in Germany are one of the highest in the world, maybe revisiting defense spending. So it's a lot of things they can do to at least in cyclically, help the economy to grow a little bit better, but also structurally maybe address some of the challenges that Germany has had in the past. So there's a number of drivers that can get better. We talked also about the European support for Ukraine. If that were to come down, again, that's an incrementally positive factor combined with everything else that could basically help European assets do better looking forward, exactly as you said, given that Europe is being very unloved by international investors.
Mm-hmm. And then on to our last question. One more other factor that is influencing markets will obviously be the ECB rate cuts. We are expecting the ECB to cut at twice the pace of the Fed this year. So how is this likely to impact investors?
Good point. Over the last couple of years, with interest rates being very high, consumers or private investors in general, they saw less of an incentive to invest in the markets. They parked a lot of their money in cash and they were receiving reasonable return for that cash investment. So as those cash rates come down, then I think more and more investors will be thinking, well, actually, that's not, it makes a lot more sense to invest, whether it's bonds or whether it's equities, other assets, rather than just park my money in cash at much lower rates. So that would, again, be another positive for the economy, because most probably will be spending more, but also for the assets in general and the markets should be supportive.
All right. Thanks, Themis. Thanks also to our listeners. We can delve into specific securities on these podcasts, but you can explore some of these with your UBS representative. And we also very much recommend our Equity Compass, which goes into full detail about where we see the most value. But just to sum up here what Themis has said today, we believe investors should concentrate on opportunities in small and mid-cap stocks, as well as sectors likely to benefit from anticipated central bank rate cuts. And in the event of a ceasefire, we see potential in the construction, engineering, and infrastructure sectors. Additionally, we favor bonds issued by slightly more defensive and domestically oriented companies, targeting an average duration of around 5 years. We'll be back soon with another installment of Across the Pond, and in the meantime, have a great week.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.